If you'll turn in your Bibles to the Song of Songs, chapter 6, we'll begin our study as we continue to work our way through the poems that make up this song. We're in the fifth poem today, which is focused almost solely on the beauty of the woman. We've seen up to this point a variety of things, but we've seen them focus on the beauty of each other and the desire they have for each other at various points. And this is going to be one of the things that is unique about the male's perspective that I think does kind of reflect reality, of course, is that there are these wasps, as they are called, the technical term for the poetic description of physical beauty. And you say, why do you use that technical term that's so hard to say? Because it's one word instead of saying over and over again, poetic description of physical beauty. So wasp it is, however awful that word is. But that's what they're called. We've seen one from each of them up to this point. So in the third poem, you find the first wasp from the male to the female. In the fourth poem, you see her responding one. But in this poem, he actually gives two different ones. And so altogether through the song, there are three by the male and one by the female. And again, I think that kind of reflects reality, that the male is going to be more obsessed and focused on the beauty of the female than vice versa. However much she may find him appealing and be attracted to him, that's not the sort of thing that stereotypically, at least, the women are going to be quite as focused on as the male is. And so that may just be a reflection of the reality that he keeps coming back to that idea. But we will see two of those over the span of this poem as we are working our way quickly toward the end. And so next week we'll be wrapping up the poems themselves, and then we'll spend a couple of classes at least doing some sorts of topical studies, hitting some of the ideas and big picture themes that we've run through as we've gone through these and trying to bring some of those principles together a little bit more clearly. And then middle of November, we'll switch gears completely and turn to the Book of Lamentations and focus on the other extreme of emotion in Hebrew poetry there. And so, as I said at the beginning of this class, if someone is interested in a short class commitment, Lamentations will be coming up soon. And if not, I guess I'll continue on if no one else is interested when we get to that point. So that, as far as introduction goes, we'll begin looking at this poem in just a moment. Let's begin, though, with a prayer. Our good Father, we're so thankful to you for all that you do for us. We're thankful for your word, which shows us how we are to live as your people and teaches us the great truths and wisdom that you know that we miss so often, and that left to our own devices, we would fall so short of living up to. And Father, as we consider yet again the physical love that this poem speaks of in the marriage relationship, we ask that you would help our hearts to be open to the truths that are here. Help us to submit ourselves to what you have revealed to us. In your Son we pray. Amen. All right, so we'll start with the first part of this poem, which is his second description of her physical beauty. And we're not going to spend as much time talking about this in detail because there's a lot of this that is just a repeat of what he has said before. I don't know that that means he's unimaginative, because he is going to expand his descriptions further in the third one of these. But this is going to sound very familiar. It sounds a lot like what he had to say back in chapters 3 and 4. Chapter 6, beginning in verse 4, "You are as beautiful as Tirzah, my love, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners. Turn away your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from the washing. All of them bear twins. Not one among them has lost its young. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother who bore her, or pure to her who bore her. The young women saw her and called her blessed, the queens and concubines also, when they praised her. Who is this who looks down like the dawn, beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome with many banners?" And so he speaks first, and as we said, this is largely a repeat of what he said in the beginning of chapter 4 with a few points of difference, but a lot of the ideas are the same. You know, the flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead is to give you the idea of the flowing hair, perhaps the dark, lustrous color of it as well. The teeth like a flock of ewes that have come up from washing with none having lost its young. It's a full set of nice white teeth is the idea there. And those kinds of things. A few points of difference, though, is to start the reference to Tirzah and Jerusalem at the beginning. These are, of course, major cities in the northern and southern kingdoms, respectively, or what would become the northern and southern kingdoms, respectively, depending on when exactly this book was written. Perhaps by referring to a great city in each part, it's a way of denoting all of Israel, you're as beautiful as all of the promised land, or something along those lines. Or maybe that has nothing to do with it at all. The names of the cities may be meaningful. Jerusalem is one of these SLM words from the Hebrew. And again, it's a consonantal language. The vowels were added later on. And SLM is the same root as shalom, which of course is this word of peace and wholeness and completeness and a whole bunch of other things that no good English, or there's no good translation into a single English word. But the idea of peace and wholeness for Jerusalem. And Tirzah sounds a whole lot like the word for pleasure. So it could be kind of a play on words there of peace and pleasure, wholeness and pleasure, or something like that. Maybe the point of emphasis rather than, you know, what it represents beyond that. The war banners is kind of an idea of how these, you know, people would inspire awe with their power. Army marching with these grand war banners, if you see them coming, it's just this amazing thing. And so that's a lot of the idea there, I think, is just the amazement of seeing it. And that might be part of the idea of the cities as well. It's hard to know exactly what he means by these cities. Are you as beautiful as the promised land by mentioning a city in each part? Are you peace and pleasure by playing on the names? Or is it just that amazing feeling you get sometimes when you walk into a big city for the first time and you just look around and you're like, wow, this is incredible, especially if you've never been in a city like that before. And so that may be the idea. Whatever it is, obviously it's intended to be complimentary. However, the specifics are worked out. Verse 5, I think, is noteworthy as well in terms of the sort of feelings that she produces in him. Turn your eyes away from me, for they overwhelm me. You know, you hear this sort of line in love poetry and love songs, the power of the eyes. And that's the point here, of course, as well, is the power of her gaze. And that she must be the one to initiate the separation of their eyes. He is so entranced that he can't even look away himself. They overwhelm me, but I can't look away. You have to be the one to turn your eyes away from me. Seems to be part of this idea as well. And then the other part of this that is different from the previous description is as it comes to the end, 60 queens, 80 concubines, virgins without number, the young women who saw her called her blessed, queens and concubines also, they praised her. And so this idea of all of these other women around praising her and thinking she's so great, and that is really only to confirm what he says as well. 60 queens, 80 concubines, virgins without numbers to say there are women everywhere I look, incredible women. I mean, queens and concubines aren't going to be the lowest level of femininity in the ancient world. Obviously, these are the ones the kings are most interested in, whether for their beauty or their power or something else. But in response to that, my dove, my perfect one, is the only one. It's this one in a million idea that we've seen previously really being emphasized here. In the face of all of these other women, she's the only one. And then it comes back to them again, and instead of being competition, so to speak, they are reaffirming the praise. They saw her and called her blessed, which is at least a little bit reminiscent of Proverbs 31, where all who see this worthy woman rise up and call her blessed. But they call her blessed. The queens and concubines too, they praise her. And apparently verse 10 is their statement, who is this who looks down like the dawn, beautiful as the morning, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners. And so that idea of the wonder of the army with banners comes up again as they look at her and speak of her beauty. Charlie, were you going to say something? Well, I mean, that's just without having any real insight into who exactly he is and what he's doing and where he's going and how his mentality is changing, it's hard to speak to his perspective. I do think you're onto something, that the images have changed. They begin very much the same, but it moves away kind of from this countryside imagery more to this city royalty imagery, whether it's Jerusalem and tears of the army with many banners, the queens and concubines all fit that as well. Beyond noting that there is at least a slightly different basis for some of the comparisons in that way, it's kind of hard to say too much about it.
As you explained that I've gone through this, it reminds me that this could be the advice, and maybe the advice that is given by modern marriage counselors or taught in the,
Marriage and the Family.
Marriage and Family course, about how a man treats his companion, because many men tend to settle in and ignore their companions and so on, but the praise that a husband can give to his wife is one of the best things that can happen.
Yeah, I think that is right. And it's one of those things as well, especially in, I mean, there's no real sense of time passing where you can put this on any sort of timeline. But, I mean, if we take the poems as at least roughly being in chronological order, and, you know, we have them married basically in poem 3, and then there is this, I don't want to call it a fight, but a little bit of a difficult circumstance in chapter 5 in her dream, where, you know, he can't get to her and she finally goes to him and he's gone, and then there's all this stress that happens as a result of it. And if this poem is kind of in response to that poem, there is even, I think, something more going on here along those lines, that whatever happened in the previous poem is not a barrier to where they are now. It hasn't changed how he thinks about her. And then also, I mean, however much time has passed from their marriage, this is still how he thinks about her. And that, I think, is something that you see over in Proverbs 5, because Proverbs 5, as it talks about marital love, is clearly talking about it from a broad perspective of live your whole life with this kind of perspective toward your spouse. And it keeps alluding back to this language from the song. And, I mean, if you take the entire song as young love, new love, you know, leading up to your wedding and the honeymoon and the first year after, and so you're, I mean, if you're jaded and long, no one's going to think like that forever. Well, Proverbs 5 says think like that forever. And so you do kind of come back to that idea of this continual admiration of your spouse. And that's one of those things that it's harder, it's certainly not impossible, but it's harder to be drawn aside by someone else if you are continually admiring your spouse. There's less temptation to be pulled aside by someone who may, you know, in one way or another, seem better if you're constantly focusing on the positives of your spouse. If you're focusing on the negatives, then yeah, you can find someone who seems a lot better in a hurry. You know, this person is 98% right for me, and there's 2% wrong, but if you focus on that 2%, you can find someone else out there that has that going, even though that's the only thing they have going for them, and it'll lead you astray in a hurry. So focus constantly on the positives, whether it's the physical, like these poems are emphasizing, or something more important than that even. Joy, were you going to say? No, Jonathan. And even if not beautiful in any kind of traditional sense, even though I think what you're speaking of, yeah, even if what you're speaking of, I think there is beauty in that sort of scene, but certainly majestic and awe-inspiring. And those all, I think, kind of go into the idea of looking at this woman. Dan? Yeah. Yeah. All right, well... The next two verses, it's hard to know for sure who is speaking. There's no clear distinction from the previous speech. So it may be the male continuing on, but it seems to go with, 11 and 12 seem to go together. Suddenly there is this I perspective. I went down to the nut orchard to look at the blossoms of the valley to see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranates were in bloom. Before I was aware, my desire set me among the chariots of my kinsmen, a prince. And so these two verses seem to go together, and the idea of being swept away by her prince, so to speak, would seem to indicate that it's the woman speaking, but this is, of course, a debated issue. What's more important than that is to kind of know what's going on here. And verse 11 is the key verse of the two in terms of carrying forward the theme of this particular poem, where what you find is this person, the woman, for the sake of me picking something to move forward with. She is searching for signs of spring, basically. Went down to the nut orchard to look for blossoms, to see whether the vines had budded, whether the pomegranate... She's looking for spring. Has spring sprung, so to speak? This is reminiscent of what we've seen already in the song as well. Back in chapter 2, remember, everything is in bloom. The time is right for love is what everything is screaming at them. Chapter 4, where he describes her body as a garden in bloom. And so now she is seeing if everything is in bloom again. Is the time right for love is basically the idea. And again, it's interesting to read this in the context of the fourth poem, where things did not go quite so well in her dream there. And for her to find, no, the time is right, you know. He'd previously turned away, perhaps in anger, but now they are together again. Now, verse 12 itself is probably the most difficult verse to translate in the entire song. Some people have actually called this one of the most difficult verses to translate in the entire Old Testament. So different translations handle it differently, and it's hard to know for sure exactly what all the details of this verse mean. The basic perspective of it seems to be that there is still desire, and again, Prince Charming, so to speak, sweeps her away in his royal chariot. Beyond that, it's hard to get really specific because it's just such a difficult verse to translate. I mean, any translation can be difficult in places. Hebrew poetry can be notoriously difficult because one of the hallmarks of Hebrew poetry is brevity, where they will condense a sentence down as short as they can. They'll cut out verbs and stuff, and you just have to kind of understand what the basic idea is. And this is one of those things that's, I mean, in English, in the ESV, before I was aware, my desire set me among the chariots of my kinsmen, a prince. In the Hebrew, it's like six words long or something. So it's just a really difficult verse, and I don't want to get too bogged down on it. But again, it matches this idea of the desire. She's gone to the gardens to see if there is spring, and she finds that there is desire. I think it's pretty clearly the basic idea of these two verses. Anything here before we move on? Well, this then leads to the, not the third description yet. It's a call for the Shulamite to return by her friends. Presumably, some have suggested that this is the beginning of him speaking rather than a different group of people. And again, if you're reading from a translation that puts headings over each of the sections of speech, some will say it's him, some will say it's the chorus or the others or the daughters of Jerusalem or however it handles that idea. What's that? It has both. Yeah, so some will split verse 13 down the middle, and that's actually, I think, what's going on as well. I've got 6:13a as him, and then 13b and following as the man. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look on you. And the plural there, we may look on you, I think is your clue that it's more than one person speaking. And if she was once one of the daughters of Jerusalem, so to speak, return so we can see you again. Could certainly fit that idea. What's most interesting about this, far more interesting than figuring out who is saying it, is this reference to her as the Shulamite. This is the first place where we have any kind of designation given to her at all. And there are a variety of ways that this has been understood. Some people have seen it as just, a very basic, place description sort of name. A Shulamite is a person from Shulam. Obviously. The problem with that is there is no place named Shulam that we know anything about inside the Bible or outside the Bible. So if this is Shulam, that's kind of hard to pin down. I guess it could be Yerushalem, Jerusalem, but that's really would be an odd way of referring to her as a Shulamite, as being someone from Jerusalem. And so that's probably not the best option. Some have suggested that it's a scribal error. We know scribes made mistakes from time to time, and there are places in the manuscripts where the best thing scholars can do is guess that the scribes have made a mistake, and it must have been this word instead. And some have suggested that this should be Shunammite instead of Shulamite. And in particular, Abishag, if you remember her, was a Shunammite woman. And so some have made that connection and presumed that Abishag is the Shulamite woman, the Shunammite woman, this young girl who kept David warm, and then Adonijah wanted her later as his own. And so Abishag's the woman in question for the whole song. And that is, I guess, attractive from one perspective, but the problem is there's no connection anywhere in the historical narrative between Abishag and Solomon. All the women Solomon ever has, Abishag doesn't ever seem to be one of them. And so that's an odd thing for her to suddenly be this woman, unnamed except for a typo that might refer to her. It's a little bit of a stretch to get to that point. And so I think two better suggestions about this is, one, going back to the Hebrew consonantal language, she's the SLM woman as far as being the Shulamite. And the man, as we've said, is kind of metaphorically Solomon. She could then be understood as the Solomoness, the female Solomon figure, as far as that goes. And in her own way, she is Solomon as well, so to speak. Or the other way of understanding it is that she is the Shalom woman, the Shulamite in that sense, where, again, Shalom is not just peace, but also wholeness and perfection. She is the perfect woman. Would be the idea as far as the Shulamite goes, if that's what it means. And again, it's hard to be too dogmatic about it. Those are some of the options that have been suggested over the years. I'm not convinced personally by her being a person from a place called Shulam. I'm not convinced that she should be the Shunammite and therefore Abishag. I think the other two are better options, but it's hard to know for sure what's going on there. Any thoughts about that before we move on? Again, I don't want to get too bogged down on these little nitpicky kinds of things. Yeah, Jonathan?
Is this a response to her being
Yeah. Yeah, it's either in response to that image of being swept away by the chariots, in which case, I guess you could make sense of him saying it even, you know, come back to me, especially if you take a three-person view, but that's a different story. Either that or it's just to set up what follows. That verse 12 is kind of the end of scene A of this poem, and this is the lead-in to what follows. Because what he's going to say in response is, why should you look upon the Shulamite as a dance before two armies, which is its own difficulty. And then that leads to his next description of her and looking at her. So either it's kind of a segue or it's just the beginning of a new thought. So let's move then to his third description of her physical beauty. And so he begins by responding to these daughters of Jerusalem by saying, basically, stop looking at her. She's not for you to look at. She's not for your entertainment, basically, is the idea, I think, there. And then he describes her physically from the feet to the head. And as we've seen, the previous three descriptions, I guess, begin with the head and work down. This is a description that begins with the feet and work up. So it's different in that regard. It's also the most descriptive of all of them. He started with describing her in 7 points. Then, as Brian pointed out, when she described him with 10 points. Now he's going to describe her with 14 points of her body, and again from the feet to the head instead of vice versa. But like before, most of the descriptions are given to the head, at least in the initial description, and then that changes when he comes back and refocuses, because after the general description, he then returns to refocus on specific features of her. So let's talk briefly about the last half of verse 13. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as a dance before the two armies or two camps? Again, this is a bit difficult to know specifically what's going on. Some have suggested that there was a specific dance called the dance before the camps or the dance before the two camps or something that we just have no idea what it was, but it was a dance that everybody back then would have known what was being talked about, which is certainly a possibility if you're looking for something specific. I think a better idea is, you know, she's not some sort of entertainment for you to stare at. She's not some dancer for you to watch, is the basic idea. Why should you look at her like that, is the basic idea. And then he goes on to describe her specifically in terms of how he sees her. So, how beautiful are your feet in sandals, O noble daughter. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are the pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bathrabim. Your nose is like the tower of Lebanon, which looks toward Damascus. Your head crowns you like Carmel. That's the mountain, not the candy. And your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in its tresses. How beautiful and pleasant you are, O loved one, with all your desires. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I say I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its fruit. O may your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. And then she is going to speak in the middle of his sentence and continue it on from that point, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. So a few points of on this description of her that's worth mentioning. First of all, he begins, again, with her feet and works up. And I don't know if it's just in general because it's going to be something different this time or if it's connected to what he has just said, this idea of a dance. It's a natural thing for him to be focused on the feet in a dance, and he just starts there on the heels of that discussion. No? Okay. So the feet in sandals is kind of the natural starting place. He then mentions her rounded thighs, which we would probably say in our vernacular, her curvy hips or something along those lines is the idea. And refers to it not just in terms of thinking about her curves, but seeing them as the work of a master hand. And we've talked about how God does not come up a whole lot in the song. There's one spot we'll see in the last poem where God may be referred to more overtly there. But it's been suggested, and I have a hard time arguing with it, that this idea of her form being the work of a master hand may in itself be a subtle reference to the Creator as well. We mentioned in her description of the man a verse that may well be a euphemism. Here is another one, his reference to her navel. It's out of place in an upward description of her body between her thighs and her waist. If it is her navel, it's out of place. And also, it's an odd point of emphasis in the analogy if it's a reference to her navel. So that's, in my reading, most likely a euphemistic reference, but that has been suggested otherwise as well. The reference to her belly as a heap of wheat. Guys, when you're trying to woo the women, heap of wheat probably is not your best bet. Your belly's like a heap of wheat. This is been explained in a couple of different ways. One that I think makes more sense probably in an ancient context, and one that would make more sense in our ears. Some have suggested that it's more like a shock of wheat rather than, you know, a big round bale of hay, where they would take a bunch of wheat stalks, put them together, and tie them in the middle. In which case, what you'd wind up with is something kind of like the hourglass ideal of femininity that we imagine now. And that works really, really well for how we imagine things now. The question is, was that their ideal back then? Because cultural beauty standards change. And a lot of times in the ancient world, they preferred more matronly women than our culture seems to think is ideal. And one of the reasons why is because, I mean, if you're poor, you're always in danger of starvation. If you're wealthy, you have plenty to eat, and there's a little bit more meat on your bones. And the appeal of wealth and social status, that's what those women looked like. And so I think that kind of became part of their ideal of beauty, is the ideal of social status as well. And there are plenty of images from the ancient world of these women who you might almost say look a little bit pregnant from time to time as the ideal of beauty. And so it may be a heap of wheat, as we might think of that in a negative context. They're a little bit more rounded in terms of the ideal of beauty in that context. So, you know, they don't want their women to look like they're on the verge of starvation, as some of our, you know, cultural ideals seem to be from time to time. I think we've kind of gone away from that a little bit in the last 10 or 15 years. I remember back in the 90s, well, let me nod. All right, so speaking of things not to try to woo your women with, your nose is like a Tower of Lebanon. That'd be pretty high on the list as well. Just how big was her nose, I think, is the natural question that you would ask along these lines. But of course, the idea is not the size of her nose, I don't think, is the point. And it's been described in terms of the strength and the security. We kind of talked about that with the neck being described in comparison to a tower previously. The shields hanging on the neck there, that strength and security that comes with that. Or stateliness and straightness could be part of it as well. One commentator said kind of like a tower on a hillside sets it off in contrast and the beauty of it on the hillside. And that's kind of what her nose is like on her face. I don't know if that's the idea or not, but it's at least kind of an example of how you can look at this sort of statement and say, okay, that's not quite as awful as I thought it was the first time I read it. You know, for us, that sounds a little bit more like an insult than a compliment. Whatever it exactly means, it's clearly to be taken complimentary rather than anything else. Notice also the proliferation of place names. I mean, we saw Jerusalem and Tirzah in the first of these wasps today. Gilead shows up there as well. And then now all of a sudden we've got Heshbon and Beth Rabim and Lebanon and Damascus and Carmel all showing up consecutively as well. And again, it's hard to know what to make of that too specifically, but it is pretty clear that there is this focus on places showing up and being compared to specific places. Carmel in particular is interesting. Mount Carmel, of course, was pretty well known. But probably why it shows up here is not because, you know, Mount Carmel is the greatest of all mountains. It wasn't even the highest of all mountains in Palestine. But it was kind of a center of the purple industry. There have been a lot of purple manufacturing areas discovered in this region, and some of the plants that were grown to make the purple dye grew very well in this region. And so your head crowns you like Carmel, your flowing locks like purple. That's the probably the point of the reference to Carmel is it is kind of the height of this industry, which of course was wrapped up in wealth and value and royalty and regality and all of those kinds of things. It's probably why those show up in tandem. And then verse 6 is kind of a summation statement of all of it, bringing to its close this description of her body. He has gone from her feet to her head. And as we've said before, the bulk of the focus is on her head, neck, eyes, nose, head, hair. Is, what was that, 5 of the 14? And so it all comes to a conclusion here. So you might think, how beautiful and pleasant you are, kind of bookends with how beautiful are your feet in the beginning of this. But then after that summation statement, wrapping up this description and ending his description of her beauty, he then goes back and talks about her beauty some more, specifically in reference to her breasts and her mouth. In verses 7 through 9. And here the idea is not just seeing them, but experiencing her body. It's not enough to just look at her and see her, but he wants to share with her an intimate contact between them. And so he describes her as a palm tree, and this is a date palm tree, which you can find ancient inscriptions and drawings of a date palm, and they were invariably drawn as a tall, slender tree with a cluster of date palms on either side, symmetrically arranged, and that's kind of the natural reason why this is chosen as the image. It is interesting that the word for date palm is the word tamar, the Hebrew word tamar, or as you would say if it was a proper name in the Bible, Tamar. It's the same word, and there are two Tamars in the Bible that come to mind very quickly, both of whom are beautiful girls that have a story with a sexual theme in them. And I don't know if that's just coincidence or if we're supposed to make that connection as well. But he moves from this description of her as a palm tree and her breasts as the clusters of the palm tree to the scent of her breath and her mouth. And again, as we said before, this word for mouth is the word for the inner mouth. It's the palate of the mouth. And as we said when we saw this word, when she was using it, it's the move from the lips to the inside of the mouth, which again is a focus on intimacy at this point. And they're joining together. And then she just kind of jumps right in, and I'll give you a second to comment on that last part of the poem in a moment if you want to. But this is an interruption. This is one of those spots where translations clean things up too much sometimes. The ESV sticks a period in a new sentence. In your mouth like the best wine, period. It goes down smoothly for my beloved, she says, gliding over lips and teeth. It's really more along the lines of, he says, like the best wine. And she finishes his sentence, like the best wine flowing smoothly to my lover. And so she just jumps in and continues the sentence. And it's almost certainly her, because she is the only person in the song at any point who refers to the other one as my beloved or my lover, depending on your translation. So that's your clue that she's jumping in mid-sentence and finishing his thought, which is basically her invitation to him. So he wants to share with her. He wants to be intimate with her, and she jumps in mid-sentence to affirm that that is the case. So that or anything in the description that he gives is open for comment, Guy.
In verse 8, my translation gives a strange term, the fragrance of your breath, and it says the fragrance of your nose. In verse 8, literally your nose. fragrance of your nose like apples?
Yeah, that's the word that is really the... I would have to look and see if there's like a manuscript difference or if they're translating from the Septuagint or something. The Hebrew word that is there is the inner mouth, the palate of the mouth. So it's either a manuscript difference that says nose, and that's why they're going with that, or if it's an old enough translation where they didn't know the word and they were taking a stab at it, because that, I mean, some of the older translations did that from time to time. Yeah, that's... Verse 8. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah, verse 9, beginning of verse 9. Your mouth like the best wine? Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. The scent of your breath like apples. So, yeah, I was wrong, guy. The word that I was talking about is in verse 9. Your mouth is like the best wine. The scent of your breath. So you say range of meaning there, Adam? Okay. That I would have to look up where nose came from. I mean, if it's the scent of your breath, it could be literally the nose, but the idea being not the nose, but what comes from it, the breath, in which case... It's probably just an oddity of images that we would, you know, we wouldn't make that connection, nose to breath, to the scent of the breath, but in their thinking it may be a really natural sort of jump. Well, it's the breath, obviously. The breath has a certain smell, so I don't know. All right, well, she then, again, she interrupts and restates her commitment to him. I am my beloved's. And my desire, or his desire, is for me. And we've run into this, and this has been brought up as well. But just briefly, to touch on this, we've seen a progression in the thought here. Chapter 2, in verse 16, she says, "My beloved is mine, and I am his. He grazes among the lilies," and there is this kind of affirmation of their mutual ownership. She then says in chapter 6, in verse 3, "I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine," where she flips the order, and emphasizing first that she belongs to him, I am his, and he is mine. There's still the mutual ownership, but it changes the point of emphasis. And here it is completely different, I guess completely different to a degree. I am his, and his desire is for me. So the final statement is no longer this mutual ownership idea, but that he desires me. And that's an interesting thing, because this idea of the desire for another one shows up in a couple of places back in the book of Genesis, including Genesis 3 as part of the curse, that the woman will desire her husband. And when you read that in tandem with Genesis 4, where God tells Cain that sin's desire is for you, your desire will be for him, he says to Eve, those phrases are obviously parallel to one another. And in Genesis 4, it clearly means sin desires to rule over you. And I think the meaning in Genesis 3 is you will desire to rule over him, but you should submit to him. And here it takes this idea of desire, if we were to read this in conversation with those other verses, and takes what is a negative previously and sees it as a positive instead, where he desires her. This is another way of saying she submits herself to him. But instead of seeing it in a negative context of conflict between them, here it is seen in a positive sense. That in a marriage that is correct, there is this willing giving of self rather than a battle for preeminence that Genesis 3 seems to be speaking about. And then as it comes to a conclusion here in verses 11 through chapter 8 and verse 4, "Come, my beloved, let us go into the fields and lodge in the villages. Let us go out early to the vineyards to see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give forth fragrance. Beside our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. Oh, that you were like a brother to me who nursed at my mother's breast. If I found you outside, I would kiss you and none would despise me. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, and she who used to teach me, I would give you spiced wine to drink, the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. And so 11 through 13 of chapter 7 is kind of, again, this investigation into the garden to see if spring is here. Mandrakes in particular, that they come up as significant. That was a known aphrodisiac in the ancient world. The idea of new and old, that she has laid up for him, the kind of constant newness of love, in the right relationship, the right way, there is this constant newness. And then the chapter 8, 1 through 4, which just quickly, again, speaks of her desire for him. She wishes that he was her brother, not in any kind of creepy ways that we might naturally think of that. Oh, that's really weird. I wish he was my brother so I could kiss him. The idea is, in the ancient world, it was inappropriate for a woman to kiss a man, including her husband, publicly, unless they were related. And so the idea is, I wish I could kiss you. That's all that really means. I wish we were related so I could kiss you because I want to kiss you, is the bottom line there. And take you back to my mother's house, which was back in chapter 3, the place that she wanted to take him in that first dream, the place of love is what that was. Verse 3 is again this embrace. And then verse 4 is again this refrain of restraint, which is an odd spot to find it. Up until the marriage in poem 3, it made sense to find it where they were kind of putting the brakes on. Here it's an odd spot to find it, except perhaps that public is not the right time for this, and so they still have to wait until the time is right. And that may be the idea of it showing up here. All right, I'm out of time, so I'll stop. We'll wrap up the text of the song next Sunday.